Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premiere Networks on Saturday. That's March 24th, 2018. This is episode 1473. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ActiveCampaign. If you have a growing business and you want to acquire more customers, you need ActiveCampaign. Their solution goes beyond marketing automation, so you get the right type of message to the right person at the right time. For a free trial, go to activecampaign.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Oh, yeah, tech guy time. Your worst nightmare, a geek with his own radio show. This is the show. I crack myself up. This is the show where we talk about technology, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, augmented reality, real reality, all that stuff. Anything with a chip in it. Now, I'm a geek, but you don't have to be to listen to the show. I try to talk in English. I try to translate. Sometimes I succeed. Sometimes I don't. If you say, what did you just say? You can call 8888-ASK-LEO if you have a question. Maybe you want some translation from the geek speak down at the local computer shop. 888-827-5536 is the phone number. The website is techguylabs.com, and you'll see a link there at the website for a chat room, which you can join as well at irc.twit.tv. This is, we call it Team Tech Guy. These are the smart, fine, and above-average-looking people who convene there to help me with answers to your questions. So when you call, you're asking not just this poor servant of the technological future, but you're also asking them. And they also, they have friends too. So we can get a lifeline if we need to. 8888-ASK-LEO. You like my slide rule? Somebody in the chat room saying, nice slide rule. I bought on eBay one of those big classroom slide rules because it's an artifact of another era. It probably many of you are old enough to remember the, you know, in the high school math class or maybe the science class, the giant yellow wooden thing hanging about 6 feet, 7 feet long. It was hanging up there, and the teacher would use it to show you how to use a slide rule. Even in my ute, these many years ago, people started in around high school getting calculators, but that was a pretty fancy person. A calculator was, you know, $1,000, these calculators in the 70s. Very expensive. Really, actually, these early calculators, including the Hewlett-Packard calculators and the Texas Instrument calculators, were the precursor of the first personal computers. It turned out that, who was it? I believe it was Texas Instruments. Somebody commissioned Intel to make a cheap calculator chip. Intel was a brand new company at the time, and they made something, I think it was the 4004. They said, you know, we're not so far off from producing a general purpose computing chip. Maybe we ought to do that. We could make inexpensive computers. It wasn't that much longer after that, maybe 5-10 years, that the first personal computers, based on the successor to the 4004, the 8008, and then later the 8080, and then the 8088, were created, and that was the beginning of the computer revolution. But before that, we sometimes colloquially called slipsticks. They were slide rules that took advantage of a kind of clever mathematical hack. Turns out, if you add logarithms of numbers, it's the same as multiplying them. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have gotten into this. So the slide rule added numbers on a logarithmic scale, and in effect did multiplication and division, and it was pretty cool. They weren't very accurate. Actually, slide rules were used to teach something I wish they taught these days. one of the things you learned right away with slide rules is, you know, you could say, you know, 1/3 of 1 or 1 divided by 3 was 0.3. You could say it was 0.33 or 0.33333 to infinity, right? All of them, actually, the most accurate is, I guess, the 1 to the infinity. Even then, it's not perfectly accurate. It's 1/3. But it expressed as a decimal, you have to express it with lots of threes. And people were tempted to say, well, it's 0.333333. But you couldn't be accurate to that fourth or fifth place. And a slide rule really would make that clear. Well, it's about 0.3, give or take. Slide rule made it very clear. You can only be so accurate. And I wish we'd remember this because it turns out computers have the same problem. They can only be so accurate. With integers, whole numbers, they can be perfectly accurate. But as soon as you get to decimal arithmetic, in a computer world, they call it floating point arithmetic because the point can move around. It's floating. Just like the name, the value's floating too. And in fact, there was an Intel chip that couldn't do floating point math accurately because it couldn't. It was a bug. It would get the wrong answer. So I wish, but this is a lesson we didn't learn. And you see this all the time in the news and stuff where people say, you know, 78.643% of all Americans. And it's not, you don't have that kind of accuracy. So the slide rule was kind of good for something. Something we now think because we have a calculator that says 0.333333, that must be right. That's the most accurate representation. Yeah, there was, maybe that's a lesson we could bring back. So I'm bringing back slide rules. I got one of them, I guess it's really only about 5 foot, maybe 4.5 feet long, wooden yellow picket slide rule. It's even less accurate. But I've kind of have a feeling of hanging it up in the studio. Like Mr. DeVore, my chemistry professor, his teacher in high school. 8888 Ask Leo. We can talk about that. Can't talk to me on Facebook anymore. I finally had it. Have you had it with Facebook? I've had it with Facebook. You know, Mark Zuckerberg got on, you know, on TV, made all sorts of pseudo apologies. We're going to try harder, do better. But nobody's really acknowledging the fundamental truth of the matter here. Facebook's entire business, Google too, by the way, Facebook's entire business is predicated on getting as much information about you as it can and then using that information, selling that information, giving it to other people for advertising purposes. That's their whole business model. So when Mark Zuckerberg says, we're going to do better, we're going to audit these guys, we're going to hold on to your information, but they're, there's a company that was designed from day one to hoover up as much information about you as it could and sell it to the highest bidder, period. End of sentence, period. And I think we're seeing the consequences of this because now we know that, you know, Russians used it to try to influence, disrupt in our country. I'm not talking about any, you know, political candidate in general. I'm talking about the idea that the Russians love it if we're all fighting with one another. So they made sure they had really, you know, horrific ads on both sides of every issue and groups, Facebook groups, and they could do it from your likes. Later in the show, I'll tell you, this is all based on research from about 6 years ago on what likes tell you. And it turns out, and by the way, likes are still freely available on Facebook. You can find out what a person's likes are on Facebook easily enough for whatever purposes you want. If I have about 65 of your likes, I can predict your race, your gender, your sexual orientation with very high accuracy. Just 65 likes. Give me 500 likes. I know more about you than your spouse does. And this is not a flaw or a bug, as Facebook would like to pretend. This is their business model. So I realized, you know, it's not that I want to be more private because I'm not a private person, obviously. You know, more about me probably than a lot of my family does, but because I talk about it on the air. But I don't want to reward them. I don't like that business model. I don't want to reward them. More problematic, Google. We could talk about that. 8888-ASK. Leo Kim Schaffer's here. She's answering the phones. Let's get some people online. Let's talk about tech. Take a little teeny weeny break to hear from our fine sponsors who know nothing about you, and yet they've felt that they should advertise here because you're good people. They know that much. We'll be back right after this. Yeah, I have to be very careful not to accidentally log back in during the two-week period, because if I do, they go, oh, you're back, yay! And you have to start over. It's really a messed up. It's so messed up. I don't know. I think they give you the impression. They give you the impression that, you know, you control your data. Only friends can see it. Don't you get that impression? That's, you know, somebody has to ask to be your friend, and you have to approve it. And that's all about giving you the false impression that only people you approve can see your stuff. Ain't so, McGee. I didn't really quit Twitter. I just don't use it very much. The thing about Twitter that is useful, Twitter, first of all, is not collecting all that information about you, are they? You have to actively, you know, you have to put the Twitter app on your phone or something. But Twitter is useful. If somebody dies, I like to. You go to Twitter to see if they're really dead. Usually that's a good way to do it. Not always. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. It's not how you spell it, but that's okay. Hey, it's Kim Schaffer, lo and behold, answering the phones. Hello, Kim.
Good morning. I'm back.
You're a little hoarse.
It's been a long week of...
You sound sultry.
Sultry.
It's the sultry. Kim Schaffer. Hi, sultry. So, Kim, when you call, Kim will answer the phone. Hello.
Hello. I have a question
that
for
should
Leo.
That should get some calls. Hello. We'll prepare you for your appearance on national radio.
Absolutely.
And you calm people down, right? You say, take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. No one listens to this show anyway, right?
Very rarely do I get a caller that's super nervous.
No,
once in a while, it's like, I don't want to go on the air. Can I ask the question off the air? No, you can't. It's a radio show. There's a reason you're calling.
Yeah. Well, think of it this way. When you call the radio show, you're my partner in crime. You're
exactly.
Helping me make an entertaining couple of hours for the people out there. The people. We're doing it for the people.
As we've said before, if you didn't call, it would be just Leo talking.
And you've already had a taste of that, and you don't need any more. So who should I start with here?
How about Glenn in Malibu? He's got a ton of photos on his iPhone. A lot of them are duplicates, and Apple's telling him the only way to get rid of them is to delete them one by one and wants
to know if there's a better solution.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Thank you, Kim. Hello, Glenn. How's the weather in Malibu? Yeah.
Spectacular, Leo. 75 degrees somewhere.
Oh, shit. Shut up. Just shut up. So you have to, you know, this is really common. And I think Apple might have some incentive in saying, oh, yeah, you need a new phone. This is what you need, dude. You need a new, buy a new iPhone. But you don't have to do that.
I did it. I went out and bought the 10, and I've literally got 67,000 photos.
Wow.
30,000 are duplicates.
You shouldn't carry those around on your phone, that's for sure. First of all, if you lose your phone, you lose the photos. I presume that you are already backing them up somewhere. I hope you are.
I am. I back up to the iCloud.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things you can do. If you go into your photos settings on the iPhone, you can turn on the iCloud photo library. And it even says there may be a checkbox, there's a series of checkboxes that then light up once you say, okay, I want to use iCloud. Then one of them is keep lower quality copies of your photos on your phone to save space. Optimize phone storage is the checkbox. If your phone is low on space, full resolution photos or videos are automatically replaced with optimized versions. That should make some room. And the nice thing is the full-size photos are still stored on iCloud. But here's the thing. Apple likes you to do this because iCloud's not free, is it? With that many photos, you're going to have to buy 200 gigabytes or more of iCloud storage.
Yeah, I think I bought a terabyte.
Yeah, that's expensive. So let me tell you another way you can do it. Or maybe we'd make this the secondary way, which will also get these photos off the phone entirely. And that is Google Photos. It's a
got it?
Okay, that's a free service. Google Photos is much like iCloud. It's a secondary way to back up. There is a setting. I love this setting, by the way, in your Google Photos. If you go into the settings where it says, hey, would you like to delete all your backed up photos? It's under Manage Device Storage.
Okay.
Remove original photos and videos from your device that are already backed up. There's even a button that says free up space. And so once, now that means before you can free up any space, you're going to have Google Photos on your iPhone. And Apple's funny with non-Apple programs, they don't let them run in the background for very long. So what I do is I open Google Photos and I put my iPhone on the charger and I leave it open overnight. Might even take longer than that with 60,000 photos, and just let it back up till they're all backed up. There'll be a little puffy cloud with a check mark in it once they're all backed up.
Do I need to do something to keep my phone from shutting off?
Well, that's why I put it on the charger. That may have to do with your power settings. You could say leave phone on if it's on the charger. Otherwise it backs up just as long as it can stay in background, which is only 15 minutes, which means you're going to back up, you know, a few hundred photos at a time. So the trick is to get them all backed up and then press that free up space button. The reason you can do this, I mean, one of the reasons you keep all those photos on your phone is so you can show people.
Right.
Because you go, hey, let me show you the grandkids or whatever, and you got it on the phone. That's why Apple's choice is to keep all the photos there, but in thumbnail version, just suitable for showing on the phone. That takes less space, but doesn't get rid of them all. Google's solution deletes them all. And it's fine as long as you're online, because you then open, you can then open Google Photos or even the Apple Photos, and you can get the downloaded thumbnail of the picture, which is probably fine.
So for the duplicates, the best way to eliminate the duplicates is to use the Google technology.
There's really nobody wants to delete duplicates because it's hard to tell if a photo is a duplicate. That's the real challenge of it. You can't do it by looking at the photo. You can't do it by looking at the photo. There might be slight differences you miss. It's like that.
I'd be happy to miss 20,000.
I know. So you could do, you have to do it manually. There are programs you can run, but again, this is somewhat risky. First of all, Google's storage is unlimited and free. So that might reassure you a little bit about having duplicates. At least you're not paying to store them. And then what I do is I have duplicates too. And in fact, Google Photos kind of helps me get duplicates because I have it backing up from several locations. And so I often get duplicates. Periodically, I'll go through it. You can have Google Photos sort your photos. So it's very smart about this. Once it's had the photos for a few weeks, it'll have categorized them by all sorts of ways, you know, all your dog pictures, all your pictures of your nephew Joe, all of that stuff.
Sure.
And then you can either use a chronological search to delete duplicates. My problem is a lot of my duplicates are not chronological because I edited them in Lightroom and then they got re-uploaded at a different date. So you can do it by topic. You could say, well, show me all my pictures of Paris and then clean them up, that kind of thing. So you can use Google's smarts to help you with that a little bit. But you got to do it manually, I'm sorry to say. The nice thing is once it's on Google, it's on you can go to photos.google.com on your computer, and you can use your mouse to select vast swaths of photos and delete them en masse, which I find very satisfying.
Yeah, I'm noticing that the Apple seems to be going the way of Sears and Kmart and GM. They seem to be so big.
I know.
They're playing the IBM ROM.
They used to be great, and it's really sad. That's the way of all things. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you pay for the, if you pay for the Apple support, I guess you can get better support. I don't know. No Johnny Jett today. Oh no, it's Scott Wilkinson's on, but no Johnny Jett today. He's going to be tomorrow. Yeah, there's apps for Android to do it, but there's no apps for iPhone because Apple doesn't let you have access to that. What are you, crazy? What are you, crazy? Files go by Google. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I love this. I love that. I use that. Hello, Scott Wilkinson.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you. All is well.
All is well in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, Scotland. Oh, hey, we're calling you Braveheart.
That's right.
I wish ELAC sold direct.
They don't sell straight out of their website?
They don't. I want to put a bundle together.
You know, I can hook you up. I can put you in touch with those guys.
I don't want a freebie, but I would like to.
No. But I'm sure they'll take care of you.
I want to put it in my my office. I want to put the Atmos thing in there.
See, that would be pretty awesome.
They have dealer locations. That's all they have.
That's amazing. I'm surprised.
Yeah, because Aperion and what was it, Epiphone or whatever, they let you buy direct. In fact, that's pretty much how they sell. Not Epiphone.
Yeah, a lot of those companies are. Yeah. Well, I know the ELAC guys very well. They're buddies of mine.
Well,
so.
Ask them if Leo could buy it.
Direct.
I want a bundle. I want to get, you know, the tower left and right with the Atmos on top of those, the sub and the surrounds. Yep. I don't want 7. I want 5.1, not 7.1. But
right. Yeah, I think 5.1.2.
Yeah.
So maybe two overheads.
Yeah, 5.1.2. Yeah. That's it. That's a ticket.
That's the ticket.
That's it.
And would you want bookshelves for the surrounds?
Yeah.
Or more towers?
No, bookshelves for the surrounds.
Bookshelves.
Mm-hmm. It's about, I priced it out, I think it's around $2,000 for everything, which is, I think, very good for a nice set of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Was that with the S10 EQ sub?
I don't know. Oh, I didn't look at this. Maybe not with the sub. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember.
You want at least the S10 EQ,
okay.
Which is they have an S10 and an S12. That's 10-inch driver, 12-inch driver, with an app that lets you calibrate.
Nice. That's
really
what I really
nice.
Need. Yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah, that's what the EQ stands for, huh?
Exactly.
Very nice. Yeah, I was thinking the new debut 2.
Oh, that debut 2.0. That'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll.
They have a
I'll
sub. It says their debut 2 sub is the 3010.
Oh, that's a new one.
Yeah.
Does it have the app in it?
I don't know.
Well, we need to make sure.
I have Odyssey in mind, but I think the problem is Odyssey doesn't set crossover and all that stuff.
Well, it does.
It does it in the amp, though, not the...
Correct.
Because all of these have a phase crossover knob on the subs.
On the sub, and you normally don't use those. That's true.
Yeah. So it does look like there's an ELAC app that works with this somehow. Oh, here we go.
Sounds like here we go.
De-bump, de-bump, de-bump. Hey, man, that's the magic music means it's time for the magic man, Mr. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater geek.
That's me.
AVSforum.com. Each week he joins us and talks about getting better sound and vision in your man cave or your woman cave.
That's right.
Hello,
she
Scott.
Shed, I've heard it said.
Your
I've
she
heard it called.
Shed? That doesn't sound like a good place to be. I don't want to go to my she shed.
All right.
let's see. We've talked about movies. We've talked about HDR TVs, 4K. We've talked about is Atmos sound. I told you last week you were right because I saw Black Panther in an Atmos theater. It sounded so good.
Yeah.
Loved the sound. Now you've actually... converted me and convinced me that I should probably look at getting Atmos at home with a upward firing speaker. So I'm all excited about all excited about that. You know, I just saw a story. We had talked about micro LED after the CES show.
Right. That was one of the big stories.
The new screen technology. Samsung showed it at the show, but they're having trouble getting the pixels down small enough. What I didn't know is that Apple bought a micro LED company a few years ago. And the rumor is strong that Apple is working on its own displays using micro LED. Initially, yes, for the Apple Watch.
Yeah, that's what I heard. For the watch. And I'm going, what?
Well,
wait a second. That's a tiny little screen.
Yeah. I mean, they'd have
really
to get the pixels down.
What does it really need micro LED for?
Well, maybe,
they have to get the pixels way down.
And maybe battery life. Is that possible?
That could be another problem. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And then, of course, they like, but this is also how Apple works, because they like to do it on a smaller volume thing. And then if it works well, look at the iPhone. Because if you're going to make something work on the iPhone, you have to be able to make 100 million of them a year.
Yeah.
You know, you have to
and
really get good
gotta
at it.
And I got to tell you, the manufacturing process for micro LED is not trivial.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to pick what it's a process that one way to do it is called pick and place. So you actually pick up these tiny little wafers and move them around. And it has to be so precise, the placement of them, I can't imagine doing it on a watch. I mean, the distance between the individual little pixels nowadays, I think the benchmark is something like on the order of just under a millimeter. And that's fine on a TV size screen that you're going to sit 10 feet away from. But on a watch,
but Scott,
or even a phone?
Scott, this is Apple you're talking about. They love challenges.
Well, that's true.
And this is a big deal because they haven't made their own screens in forever.
I mean, yeah, that's true. That's true.
In fact, I don't know if they ever made their own screens. They always use screens from LG and other companies. Samsung makes the screen for the iPhone X.
Yeah.
So this would be a big deal if Apple, solved the problem. And, of course, they can throw a lot of money at it. Their research and development budget has gone up.
That's true.
And then maybe it'll come to the watch, and who knows, maybe even to Macintoshes.
But how much would a watch be that had a very expensive manufacturing process?
Well, they obviously have to solve it first. They bought this company, it was called, I think, MicroView in 2014. So they've had this technology.
So they've been working on it for a while. Yeah.
Oh, they have a 30,000 square foot factory building these in Santa Clara. So this is not a small, you know, Apple does nothing small.
Does nothing small. No, I admit that. I agree with that. And hey, if anybody can do it, it's them, I would say. Yeah. So more power to them. I would love to see them get the dot pitch, as it's called, the distance between the pixels, you know, down to a tenth of a millimeter or something. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. And I bet you that's what they're saying, too. In fact, those were the exact words Tim Cook. That'd be awesome.
And so it would.
And so it would.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But actually, I understated the size of the factory. 62,000 square feet.
Holy moly. Wow.
That's a big factory in Santa Clara.
That's a big factory.
And there are 300 engineers there. They're working on this.
And specifically for micro LED?
Well, that's what Bloomberg says. And Mark Gurman, who's the Bloomberg Apple guy, is the king of Apple rumors. So, it's kind of hard to hide a 62,000 square foot factory.
Yes.
My guess is that's accurate.
Well, I'm not as interested in watches and phones as I am in large screen displays.
Right.
And if Apple can improve the technology to the point where it looks good on a watch or a phone, it's going to look amazing on a big screen TV. Whether or not Apple will actually make a big screen TV with micro LED, I don't know. We've heard rumors for years about an Apple OLED TV or, you know, an Apple
maybe
this or that.
What they were waiting for. I don't know.
Maybe.
They have a separate factory for the, what did you call that? Where they place the LEDs on there, transfer?
Pick and place.
The pick and place. They have a separate pick and place. And then they also have a factory in Taiwan they just opened, Display Research Lab. So this sounds like something they're all in on.
It sounds like it to me, too.
Yeah.
Of course, they've got more money than God. So
yeah, they can afford it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I wouldn't, you know, of course, Apple's going to keep it to themselves as much as they can. That could be secret sauce when it comes to the iPhone. They need something.
Yep.
that makes them better than the other guys. But on the other hand, I could see them licensing the technology for television manufacturers, right?
Wouldn't that be awesome? That would be
and
amazing.
Any, you know, the truth is, you know how this works. People do research, fundamental research, in making this work better. Even if they keep it to themselves, kind of, it burbles out into the environment.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody is saying 62,000 square feet is tiny for a manufacturing facility. Well, they're not trying to, they're not making them in bulk yet.
Yeah, right. This
sounds
is an
big
R&D.
To me. Right, right. They're making a few at a time, see if it works.
See what works. They're experimenting.
Somebody saw the displays for the watch. They were hooked up to a big old computer with lots of wires coming out. The watch is a lower resolution thing. It's a smaller display, too, though. I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly. It doesn't need to be super high res. I think the iPhone or, you know, a phone needs to be kind of higher res.
Yes. I can't remember what the dots per that's what the dots per inch is what matters. And I can't
is
remember.
What matters.
Yeah,
correct.
I can't remember what
correct.
The DPI for the phone is versus the.
Right. And I just heard something recently about somebody achieving a breakthrough in DPI, getting like twice as dense. This is DPI is really pixel density, right?
Yeah.
It's how many pixels per inch. Or you could also express it as per square inch.
The Apple Watch displays 326 DPI. That's pretty high.
Yeah. I think I heard a breakthrough of something like 14 or 1500 DPI.
See, we've got 607, you know, DPI, almost 600 DPI in a lot of phones. That seems to me overkill because you can't, even if you hold your nose next to it, the whole point of dots per inch is getting enough so that you can't see a dot.
Right.
But it's after that point, well, that's...
It becomes pointless. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. This is the whole argument about 4K that we used to have, you know, is look, at normal TV sizes, at normal seating distances, you can't see the resolution
right.
of 4K.
iPhone
so
is 458 dots per inch. So it's higher resolution. And I think the Samsung Galaxy S9 Plus is pushing 500.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure. So, you know, I think we're as good. Actually, you know where they want to get this higher and where it might make sense for Apple to be working on this? Virtual reality and
Precisely.
Augmented reality.
And in fact, that now you're reminding me, that's what this announcement was. It was for a virtual reality headset at that super high.
Because your eyes are inches from the screen. So
that makes sense to me. Tons.
High DPI. Interesting.
I would definitely buy into VR at that kind of pixel density.
That might be really what Apple's up to. We figured it out. You and I, between us, Scott Wilkinson, he writes at avsforum.com. He's the editor over there, and he joins us each week to talk home theater. I'm sorry, I derailed your entire segment, Scott.
Totally fine.
We'll see you next week.
You bet.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll go back to the phones right after this. I'm so sorry. Fortunately, you get a little more here.
That's fine.
If you want to stick around, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll stick around.
I'll say yeah.
Tell you what. Yep. The topic I did have in mind, and we'll do it next week.
Good.
Is ultra short throw projectors.
Oh, that's a good subject. Yeah.
Because I actually got an email from somebody who said, "Where can I buy one of these old rear projection TVs?"
Why?
And I said, and I basically say, "Well, you can't. And why would you want one?"
Yeah.
And here's the modern equivalent.
Yeah.
And that's how I was going to jump off on that. So I'll do that next week.
Good. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, that's fine. No problem at all.
Something for next week.
Yeah, Mike B is asking if I've checked out Dolby Atmos on the Samsung S9 yet. No, I haven't.
So this is – I wanted to talk about this. Dolby's licensing Atmos for the most ridiculous things, including the S9.
The phone – it's a phone, right?
Yeah, and for this laptop. But it's Atmos for headphones.
Right, which is otherwise known as Dolby Headphone.
Oh, that's what they're they've rebranded Dolby Headphone to Atmos.
They've rebranded Dolby Headphone. And it adds height, and okay, it's what's called virtualization. It makes you think, it makes it seem like or sound like you've got speakers out there, including overhead. I have not heard it yet, so I don't know how good it works. I'll be interested to try that.
I'll have to turn that on. You have to pay for it on the HP Envy, but I think it comes with the S9.
You have to pay for it extra, really?
Yeah, it's like a $30 program. It's so silly.
Oh, that's kind of silly.
I know. Samsung does a nice job with audio on their phones, I have to say. Mm-hmm. They have that adapt sound, which you do a hearing aid like check. And oh, thank you, Scott.
Sure, I'll be around.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 80, I shouldn't sing. That was dissonant, wasn't it? Did not match the music. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. The phone number. Todd in Torrance, California is next. Hello, Todd.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call, and also thank you, Kim.
Oh, yes, she's wonderful.
Hey, so I'm a Project Fi user. I love it as a service for somebody who's not reliant on streaming a lot of cell data.
Yep.
But on that same token, I also like to find ways to work around cell data. So I love the FM receiver chip in our phones. And I even actually carry a transistor radio with me sometimes in my backpack. But
which phone has an FM receiver chip that you're using?
Well, I got their latest one because I had the Nexus 5X, but this is the Pixel, Moto.
The Motorola, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that has a FM radio. This was a FM radio is kind of a freebie from the point of view of the manufacturers. They get it with the Qualcomm chipset in most cases, but many manufacturers don't turn it on, or even in the case of Apple, don't because they disable the silicon, and I think they do it because the phone carriers don't like it. They say, you can listen to free radio and do exactly what you do, save data. We don't like that.
Right.
We want you to use data so we can charge you for it. So it's my guess that's why in the U.S., in fact, the National Association of Broadcasters has a big push to get FM radios back into phones. I mean, their excuse is it's for safety, and that's for sure. If the cell towers are down and the power is out and nothing's working, at least you can get a radio station on your phone. That's pretty cool. But I don't know, obviously the NAB represents radio stations, so they like it. I don't see any movement towards putting radios back in phones in the U.S., except for
What about the AM chip? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to just tune into AM 640.
And I would, too. And you know KFI would like it, but AM antenna is a little bit more complicated of a device. The FM antenna, most of these phones use your headphones as the antenna, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so because that's FM will work with a wire. AM is at such a low frequency. Let's see. It's in megahertz. Let's see. FM's in megahertz. AM's in kilohertz. So it's a lot lower. So you need a lot longer wire. So AM radios, if you look inside, they have a coil for the antenna. And I think that's my guess, and I'm sure some ham will call me or radio engineer will call me and explain this. But my guess is the reason you don't see AM radios in phones is because it's hard to get good reception. You can't put a coil radio inside a phone, coil antenna, obviously, inside of a phone. So, the phone, the carriers want you to use, and I don't know if Google's this way or not, but I don't know. But Google and AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile, and well, they'd all like you to use iHeartRadio to listen. And that way you use data, everybody wins.
Yeah, and that's just one of the things where I don't want to be strapped down to using iHeart for everything. And then
I understand. It's great to have a radio in your phone. The other problem with AM is it's a little more – I don't have an AM radio in my Tesla either, and Tesla says it's because it's more susceptible to the noise from the electric motors, and maybe there's enough noise inside a phone that an AM radio would sound bad. So it could be one of those two things.
Yeah, there wasn't much on the internet as to why there wasn't an AM receiver in phones, but you explained it.
Well, I'm guessing, and you're going to see fewer and fewer phones with FM. Remember President Trump said he wanted Apple to put radios back in their phones, and Apple said. He said, why do they turn off the radio on their phones? And Apple said, we never turned them off. They never were there. Apple designs its own silicon and I guess doesn't need to put it in there. So, oh, well. Oh, well.
Yeah. All right, sir. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. I'm a radio fan. I like it. The good news is you can go out, of course, and buy Sea Crane and others sell little portables, tiny little portable radios the size of an iPod. You could carry around with you. It's interesting though. I don't have a AM radio in my car. They phased out the cassette player a long time ago. There's no CD player either. Really, the way Tesla's, and I suspect this is true of other electric vehicles, are designed is that stream. They want you to stream. Get your audio via Bluetooth on your phone, or, you know, many cars now have LTE or 3G built into the car, and get it that way. That's what they want you to do. And then everybody wins except us. Everybody wins except the consumer. You know, we gotta make a living, gotta make money. Companies gotta get rich. Oh well. 8888 ask Leo. That's the phone number. I think there are some electric vehicles with AM radios. I think so. I think it's completely possible to shield it. I know those motors do create a lot of noise, but there you go. Chip in Cherry Hill. What kind of work you looking for, Chip?
I'm just trying to get my foot in the door.
As an actor or voiceover or?
Anything. But the thing that's stopping me right now is I go to L.A. Casting right away at $14 a month.
Yeah.
I take $90 to start off with.
There are voiceover sites. I don't know how well they work. You know, acting, you know, I don't know how the internet could help you. You certainly, you probably want to look at what, actually, you know, we're on in Hollywood on KFI. Maybe some actors will call and tell us. Do you still need an agent to get the auditions to go around, or can you just create a great website? My guess is you do need an agent, but I don't know. Certainly, you got to have a website, right? Facebook page. I have heard that you get better contracts if you have more Twitter followers. Because the studios think, well, this guy can promote himself on his Twitter feed. So you definitely want to build that social presence and build those pages. And this is a good case to have a Facebook page, a Twitter account, website. Now, there are, and I don't know how well they work, there are online sites for voiceover. One that comes to mind is Voice Bunny, mostly because it's got a great name. And the idea of Voice Bunny is they've got voice actors. Now, you're competing with thousands of others. Actually, they say 28,000. But the idea is you put your sample up there, and then people who are looking for voiceover will go there instead of the much more complex process of getting a talent agency and trying people out and all that stuff. I think that this is a growth area. Voice actors are needed, too, for games. They're needed for, you know, documentaries, filmmaking. There's a lot more of that going on. Advertisements for podcasts, that kind of thing. So Voice Bunny is one of several, but this is a place where professional voice actors can go and try to get work. So that would be a good start. At least it'll help you be a little resume builder. 8888 ask Leo, if you're a professional working in Hollywood, I know many of you listen, because as an actor, you have a lot of free time. If you do, what do you suggest? Do you have to get an agent? Do you need a manager? 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Our website, techguylabs.com. You can put a comment up there, too. It's free. No sign up. We'd love to hear what you think. Techguylabs.com. More of your calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hey, we got a brand new sponsor. Yay for the Tech Guy podcast. It's Active Campaign. If you have a growing business, this is really every time I talk to smart people like Jason Calacanis, people who know how to market, they say number one way to market, email. But you got to have a solution that makes it easy and effective, gives you the statistics you need, sends the right message to the right person at the right time. And that's Active Campaign. With their smart tools, you could show different content in your messages depending on your contact's information, interactions, social data, and interests. You could send personalized messages. By the way, you could do this on a website too, but also in their inbox or out and about on a mobile device. So you get these impressions. Your customers start to say, yeah, these guys really, they're there. They're really there for me. You could design eye-catching campaigns. They've got a great drag-and-drop campaign builder that doesn't require any skill on your part, but lets you make beautiful emails and maximize engagement with advanced A-B testing, split testing. Find the exact content, layout, and settings your subscribers respond to with up to 5 versions of split tests. Multi-user editor, it's nice. so you can have multiple people in your organization working on your connections, revision history, integrations, conditional content. I mean, it's really sophisticated. Geo-tracking, site tracking, social sharing. They'll integrate with Google Analytics. And I love it that it's mobile optimized and the image hosting is free. So look, you've got customers, identify them, nurture them, convert them, and retain them with ActiveCampaign. For a free 14-day trial, just go to activecampaign.com/twit, activecampaign.com/twit. You also get the second month free with sign-up. In fact, there's a bunch of stuff you get for free, including two free one-on-ones and free migration if you're using another product. activecampaign.com/twit for a free 14-day trial.
Hey, everybody. Nice to be with you, as always. Beatmaster was asking me if I had seen Annihilation, this movie. And the trailer really looked intriguing. I have to say I was quite interested in it. But then I kind of got the impression it was kind of more horror. It would end up being sort of more horror and terror kind of stuff. And that, I really am not interested in filling my mind with that. So I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about going, but it was made by the same guy who did Ex Machina, which I did enjoy that movie quite a bit. And he said, Beatmaster says there are some terrifying moments in it, but it's also excellent sci-fi. So, all right, maybe I'll take the plunge. I am going to see Ready Player One on Wednesday, opening night. I couldn't get a good seat at the 7 o'clock show, so I'm going at 10:15. I'm going to get out of there probably around 1 a.m. But, you know, what we do for our job. I mean, I would go see it anyway, but I want to see it as soon as I possibly can so I can write about it on AVS Forum and tell people whether I think they should go see it or not. It looks like it's going to be pretty good. So we shall see. Anyway, thanks, Mick. Graveyard Tuba says it has a very confusing ending. I don't know what that means. Are you talking about Annihilation? I did go see Tomb Raider last week. Mildly entertaining. Nothing earth-shattering or anything like that. Scooter X sent me the Rotten Tomatoes for Annihilation. Let's see what they said. It gets, an 88%. Wow. That's pretty high. I mean, Black Panther was like at 90-something percent, 97%. Tomb Raider's at 50%. A Wrinkle in Time is 41%. I liked it more than a lot of people did, Wrinkle in Time, probably because I'm fond of the book. But okay, so Annihilation, maybe I'll go see it. If it's still playing in Dolby, I doubt it's in Dolby Vision. In fact, I was looking here to see if it is in Dolby Vision, and I don't think it is. It's not on Dolby's list of Dolby Vision titles releases into the commercial cinema. So probably not. I'll just have to go see it in a regular theater. Oh man. Tim Elliott, anything we should look for as the 2018 TVs roll out? Boy, the 2018 LGs look phenomenal. I mean, they really are amazing. I'm expecting one for review next week, maybe the end of the week or beginning of the following week. Anyway, it's the processor that they're using in there looks pretty phenomenal. A big upgrade from last year. So we'll see. But I'm really looking forward to it. Sony just introduced or just announced the prices on some of its TVs, including the OLEDs. They have a 55-inch and a 65-inch, and the 55-inch is $2,800 list, and the 65 is $3,800. And this is, you know, that's not bad for OLED, for high-quality OLED. Now, they're using the same processor as they used last year. In fact, the TV is almost identical. It's the same, except that in 2017, they had a stand, an integrated stand that caused the TV to lean back slightly. And people complained about that. I found it to, I thought it was going to be distracting, and I found it actually wasn't. So I didn't really complain about it, but a lot of people did. And now this year they've got the TV standing straight up. That's the main difference between last year and this year. Now that's a great TV. Don't get me wrong. It's a really great TV. Whether or not the LGs this year will beat it in terms of processing, we shall see. We shall see. Graveyard Tuba, love that screen name, is asking, wondering if rooms with popcorn ceilings have an adverse effect on Dolby Atmos speakers that aim at the ceiling. That's actually a great question. Now, I think it wouldn't be a really significant effect, but I think it would, there would be an effect. What the popcorn ceiling, I'm sure you all know, is basically kind of a textured ceiling with tiny little bumps in it. That would act as a diffuser, an acoustical treatment called a diffuser, but it would really only affect the very high frequencies. So that's why I say it wouldn't be a tremendous effect, but it would be something. I would certainly rather see a flat ceiling than popcorn ceiling. Lumpy's asking, any update on over-the-air 4K broadcast? I don't have a specific update. I don't have any insight into the inner workings of what the timetable is. It, you know, ATSC 3.0, which would be the mechanism, the technology that 4K over the air would be broadcast. And I don't know exactly what the rollout timetable is. It's supposed to be this year, but I think it's like, it's technology is so weird, isn't it? Because some things go much faster than you expect, and other things go slower than you expect. And I think something like a rollout of the next generation of broadcast standard, like ATSC 3.0, is going to go slower than expected. They're saying, "Oh, it's almost done. It's almost done. We're gonna have trials this year," and blah blah blah. Okay, well, trials aren't the same thing as widespread adoption, because not only you've got to have TVs with ATSC tuners, 3.0 tuners in them. You have to have broadcasters that have ATSC 3.0 broadcasting. Some of the infrastructure is the same. It doesn't have to change. But other parts of the infrastructure, steps in the signal chain from production to transmission or delivery, are different. They're new. And TV stations just went through the whole process of upgrading to HD. Well, not just. It's now 10 years on or more. But it's going to take a while, I think, for them to upgrade yet again. So I don't think we're going to see any real serious deployment, shall we say, of ATSC 3.0 in 2018. Mike Heiss says ATSC late this year, early next. But remember, ATSC 3.0 does not automatically mean 4K. You're right. You're exactly right about that. Ask again in a few weeks after NAB. That's true. We'll learn much more from NAB, which is coming up in just a couple weeks, two or three weeks, I think. Let's see here. Very unlikely no sets with ATSC 3.0 till CES 2019. That's correct. We won't see any till then at the earliest. So let's see. It looks like I'm just about out of time.
Thank you, Scott.
There we go. Thank you, Leo.
See you next week. Take care.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We're talking smartphones. We're talking smart watches. Anything with a chip in it. I'd love to talk about it. Your Internet of Things devices in your home. I'm just curious. It's hard to count them up. I don't really count them, but fortunately I have a Wi-Fi device that tells me, maybe yours does, how many connected devices there are in my home. And I would guess, because I'm an early adopter and kind of a geek, that I probably have I'm on the high side for internet connected internet devices. I've got 41 currently. All at once connected on my on my Wi-Fi router. How many do you have? 41. That's I guess that's a high number. Yeah. I'm just thinking, of course, there's laptops, there's desktops, and I've got a few laptops. There's phones. I got more than one phone. And then everybody in the family, I've got a teenager, so, you know, he's got a phone and an iPad and a computer. All the TVs are hooked up, and each TV has more than one internet connection because, you know, it's got the Chromecast and the Roku and the Apple TV. And now, and I'm not normal in that respect. You don't need more than one of those, but I have to look at all of them. And then I have multiple of those. And then then there's the Internet of Things devices. And that's where the number really starts to skyrocket. The Sonos speakers, the Echo devices, the Google Home devices, the oven. Yeah, I've got an oven connected to the internet. The sous vide device. Yeah, I've got two connected to the internet. It just goes on and on and on. And the really scary thing about all this is everything connected to the internet potentially is a highway for bad guys to get into your house and to hack your stuff or try to find your Bitcoin wallet or whatever it is they do these days, or maybe just mess with you. So each one of them has to be kept up to date. Rule number one, if you're going to buy a device that you're going to take home that's going to connect to the internet, I think I can safely now start making rules for these. We've had rules for what you should do with your computer to keep it safe. That's that update rule that I've mentioned before. It comes from a book called Future Crimes. And I think it's a pretty good kind of acronym for what you should do. Maybe some overkill, but a good thing to keep in mind to keep yourself safe. You can read the update acronyms at Future Crimes, the book. It's Mark Goodman's book about hackers and so forth. But his update algorithm is pretty simple to remember. In fact, the word itself is kind of the beginning of it all. Update. Keep your stuff updated. That's true for computers. And then, you know, good passwords. Be careful what you download. Don't run as administrator. He says turn off your computer. That's the D in update. I don't say that all the time. And then encrypt whenever possible. There's a few things I'd add, you know, two-factor authentication, things like that. But when it comes to Internet of Things devices, we'll have to come up with a new acronym. I'll have to start to work on that. But the number one thing to look for, if you're going to buy a router, an oven, a refrigerator, a doorbell, a camera, yeah, I have a few of those too, and doorbell, is that they are updatable, and more importantly, I think, updatable over the air automatically. Gone are the days on our computers or our smartphones when we, you know, can be expected to check for an update. Oh, it's not updated because you didn't do it. No. Microsoft, Apple, Android, all automatically update. And that's the way it should be because, you know, people forget. More importantly, I think, if there is a big problem that one of these companies learns about, they can push out an update right away. They don't have to wait for you to check in. They just say, fix this fast. We need that for your Internet of Things devices, too. So if you've got Internet of Things devices, going forward, let's put it this way. As you buy them, number one, the first question asked, will this update over the air automatically? Very important. And it's true of good new Internet of Things devices. It's becoming more and more true of routers, for instance. It used to be a router would never get updated. We've learned our lesson with that. The big Internet attack that happened last year on DYN, on Dyn, the DNS server, happened because some college kids figured out, this was the Mirai botnet, they figured out how to get in, that a number of routers weren't very secure. They had hardwired passwords, things like that. And they'd never been updated because people don't update stuff. And so they were able to take over thousands of home routers and use them to attack the internet. So from now on, your next router anyway should be automatically updated. And you want a company that's going to stand behind it for some years and keep it up to date and fix flaws. And don't buy a internet connected doorbell or locks. Well, really true for locks, right? You know, you don't want a flaw in your lock. really true for your ovens, and less of a problem on your oven, right? What if somebody hacks my oven? It's not really, I should say, though, that it's just hacking your oven that's the problem. If they can get into the oven, if the oven doesn't have good security on its internet connection, that becomes a gateway into your house and the rest of your devices, right? Once somebody's on your network, they have lots more things they can do. So it's not just securing your oven. You turned my oven all the way up. You burnt my chicken. No hackers trying to burn my chicken, I would presume. But actually, my oven has a camera in it, so maybe they're trying to see what I'm cooking. I don't know. But it's the bigger issue of them using the device, whatever that is, to get into your system. So that's going to be number one on our list. We'll think more about what we should do with Internet of Things devices. But automatic, over-the-air firmware upgrades, number one. Number one. Change the password if there's a password to get online. You know, in your router, you should change the password. And if you don't need access to that device from the outside world, some things you do, some things you don't. I want to be able to access my video doorbell from the outside world, right? Because I want to see if there's somebody at my door. But I don't need to get my router settings when I'm at work. So turn off that WAN administration. That's what they call it in most routers. The Wide Area Network Administration. The ability to administer your router from the outside world. Well, turn that off. You don't need that. And that just gives a bad guy one more way they can mess with you, right? So we'll think of a few other things. Change the default password. That's a big one. Put that on the list. I got to make a clever acronym like Mark did. Maybe you've got some suggestions. Locking down your Internet of Things devices. We're learning more about the Uber pedestrian crash of last week. At first, you know, I had to say you have to blame the pedestrian. Now I'm not so sure. It looks like, in fact, Uber had played it fast and loose, what a surprise, with their autonomous vehicles, and they weren't, in fact, as smart as they should be. And that dash cam video should have picked up that pedestrian. That Uber should have at least slowed down and probably should have stopped. It was not her fault. Well, I mean, you could, of course, you shouldn't be crossing the road at night in the dark where there's no crosswalk, of course. But this is where self-driving cars should do better. That LiDAR, those cameras can see in the dark. They should have seen her, and they didn't. So people like Brad Templeton, who I highly respect, who's an autonomous car critic, but also supporter. I've talked to Brad for years about the future. Self-driving vehicles are smarter and better and should cause fewer accidents than humans do. But this one, mm-mm. And it looks like the blame has to be placed at the feet of Uber for not doing as good a job with their vision system. I'll put a link in the show notes to Brad's website, ideas.4brad.com, because he has a pretty good article about this and changed my mind, frankly. More of the Tech Guy Show still to come. Website, techguylabs.com. Don't forget to visit there. It's free. It's open 24/7, 7 days a week. You can search it, and if you've got thoughts and suggestions, you can leave comments, too. I'd love to hear those. Brad Templeton he's a strong advocate for self-driving cars, and I think his point is well taken that, you know, if they're going to succeed, we got the companies that are making them have to pay attention and do a better job. He says the Tempe police released the poor quality video from Uber. What it looks like a dash cam video along with video of the safety driver. Both videos show things that suggest serious problems from Uber, absent further explanation. He brightened the frame 3 seconds into the video, and you can see, he says, the white running shoes of the victim in the dash cam video. She's crossing a poorly lit spot, but this is 4.5 seconds before the impact. So he's saying the car should have seen it. The LiDAR should have detected her 3 or 4 seconds earlier, which gives them plenty of time to stop at 40 miles an hour. The human safety driver, unfortunately, wasn't looking. She was looking down to the right, probably looking at a phone. So that's another problem. He said it's possible that Uber was not using the latest LiDAR. And that was my first reaction is, you know, this is, he says, this isn't a complex situation. This is the sort of thing LiDAR sees, and it sees well at night. The Uber car also was, you know, driving at what he calls the upper range of speeds at which it's safe to drive a non-freeway. Was the LiDAR on? Was it? He also says, I have to say this sort of impact would have been handled by the fairly primitive forward collision warning systems found on a large number of cars. Anyway, the NTSB will be looking at this. And so it was an interesting article. Leo Laporte, the dreadlocked Rasta tech guy at 8888 Ask Leo. Bonnie Costa Mesa is next. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Hey.
My phone battery's still.
I'm sorry to keep you on hold so long. If Leo would just stop talking, everything would be fine. I'm sorry.
I hope it doesn't cut out while I get my answer.
Okay.
Anyway, about a little over a year ago, I finally went kicking and screaming and bought a new computer, Win 10 computer. I was very proficient with XP, and I did not want to give it up. Anyway, I had a Western Digital external hard drive that I was using with that. And when I plugged it into my new computer, it says it's empty. And I know it's not. I know all my files are backed up in there.
Do you still have the old computer? Can you check it on the old computer? Do you see it on the old computer?
Do I see it there?
Yeah. Can you see? In other words, the drive doesn't work on the new computer, but if you plug it into the old computer, can you see it?
Well, I can see it. Yeah, I can
see
it.
Well, I mean, can you see the data?
It just says that, you know, it doesn't say there's no files in there.
Can you see the data on the old computer?
The data? Is that what you said, the data or the date?
The data.
Well, I don't have it on.
Okay, so that's the first thing to do is just check. Let's see, can we... You know, I mean, if there's something, it shouldn't be anything in Windows 10 that makes it not able to see a hard drive you can see on an XP machine. But if that's the case, you would find that out by plugging the, I presume it's an external hard drive, a USB hard drive. Just take it out, plug it into the old machine. You still have it, plug it in. Can I see the data then? Well, okay, maybe there is something in Windows 10 that's not working. Or maybe the cable's bad, or maybe the port's bad, or something else is going on. But I have to say what's most likely is that there wasn't anything on that hard drive when you thought there was, even on XP. If it doesn't seem to be anything on the hard drive now, then I think it's probably likely there wasn't then. But I can't tell until you plug it into the old machine. So first step, plug it into the old machine. Is your data okay? Is it there? If it is, hey, good news. You've got the data on the old machine too, right? Back it up to the external hard drive and try again. It's always a good idea when you get a new system, keep the old system or at least the old hard drive around for a while. Make sure all the data got moved over to the new system just fine. There's a lot that other things that could have gone wrong. I mean, make sure you're, I don't know, maybe you're using a backup program. I don't know how you got the data on the external drive. The first thing we got to do is go back and look and see if you can see it on the old computer. Sometimes there are external drives. Somebody's pointing out in the chat room, this is true. I doubt you have this kind, but Samsung makes one called the T3, for instance. It's a little external USB drive. It has a special software on it that makes it invisible unless it's been installed. It's encrypted. So if there is specialized software you needed to access that drive on the XP machine, you'll need to install it on the Windows 10 machine. But the bottom line on this is Windows 10 should be able to see anything Windows XP can see. No problem. I don't think there's anything Windows 10 is doing. It's using the new NTFS file system, but guess what? It's not that new. XP used it as well. So the file system's the same. I'm looking. Maybe it's hidden. It really depends on how you got those files on there. If you drag the files on the XP machine, if you dragged them from one folder on the internal hard drive to a folder on the external hard drive, all should be well. However, if you use some specialized software or to back it up, or maybe there's Maybe there's encryption on it. There's things you can do that would make it invisible. Main thing to do at this point is assume that there's data on there that you want to keep and check on another computer to see if you can see it, particularly the computer you made it with. And, yeah, this is really a good lesson for all of us. When you move to a new computer, make sure you got a good copy of your data. And just in case, don't get rid of the old data, the old computer, the old hard drive until you verify you've got a full copy on the new one. More commonly, what you get is it looks like I got everything and I didn't. That's much more common. 8888, Ask Leo, the phone number. Back to line one, Jim, Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Jim. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
I ain't going to embarrass either one of us by telling the world how long I've been listening to you. So we will just stop there.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't really want to say you're wrong, but...
Oh, I can be wrong. That's okay.
The caller earlier who was worrying about his duplicate photos...
Yeah.
I've actually found an application that works pretty well, because I had one of those older ones. You used to have to look at the little thumbnail and then compare the thumbnails visually to figure out, you know, if these were the same photos or not. And that got real old real quick.
Yeah, no kidding. So what do you recommend?
Well, there's a program called Easy Duplicate Finder.
Yeah.
Now, it allows you to set up, you can go anything from a name to a CRC checksum, you know, and it works on Windows from XP to 10. And then since I don't speak Mac, there's like, you know, half a dozen Mac, you know, it works on the Mac also. But like I said, I have been renewing my subscription to this program for quite a while. And I am very, very, very happy with it.
Excellent. I appreciate the tip. See, I said that you would help. I knew Jim would call. I knew. I was just waiting for you. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, like I said, it's not that expensive a program.
It sounds like a good idea.
I have been using it for quite a while, and I keep renewing it because it keeps working.
EasyDuplicateFinder.com. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's tough with photos only because you can have a photo that's essentially a duplicate, but that you maybe modified slightly. It will look like a duplicate to you, but it won't look the same to something like this because it isn't the same. And that's why photos are a particularly big challenge. But hey, if it works, do it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Jeremy, Moore Park, California. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Leo, how you doing, man?
I'm great. Thanks for hanging on.
Yeah, no problem. I always love listening to you, man. You always think you have a lot of knowledge.
Thank you.
A lot of different questions have been answered by you. See if you can crack this quick one. I'm sure this is child's play for you, but
I'm always worried when I hear that. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm dead serious, man. I don't know if you have any knowledge about the Microsoft Creators updates.
Yes. Yes.
Right now I'm currently running build 17115.1R S4.
Okay.
And it's an education build. I have another computer here, which is a home build that I put on. They're both 1803. I'm just giving you the build number.
Yeah.
1803.
1803 is the, so you're on the insider's builds.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So that's problem number one, which is you've agreed to be a beta tester.
That's right.
Guess what happens to beta testers?
You've
been getting a lot of builds lately because we're getting close to 1803, which is the update, which has no name at this point except 1803, that Microsoft's going to push out in April. Big update, big spring update for Windows 10. But you probably over the last few weeks have gotten three or four new updates as they get closer to that.
Yeah, exactly. I've had about three of them total.
Yeah.
And
so what's the issue?
Well, one computer I'm running 17128.1, and then one, and that's a home build, and the other is a 17115.1 RS4.
Yeah.
Now I have a Lenovo.
RS4 is Redstone 4. That's the next version, believe it or not.
Which one is?
That's the next version of Windows. It's not the 1803 update. You're already starting to receive the next Windows Insider updates for the fall 2018 update.
Okay.
Anyway, what's the problem? Before we get in a number stew here, maybe I can help you.
What's all boring and everything?
Yeah. Because you're running beta versions and you're running different beta versions, you're going to have differing results, obviously. So.
That's correct. Okay.
You're on the skip ahead.
Right.
No, that's what they call it, the skip ahead. You're skipping ahead to the next one.
Yeah, I am, man. And I decided to do it. I just decided to try it out.
The code name for the update we're going to get this next month is Redstone 3. That new one you've got, 128, is Redstone 4. That's going to be the least reliable build of Windows out there, because that is a beta for something that won't be shipped for six more months, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So the other one, which is Redstone 3, RS3, that's a beta for something that's going to be shipped in a week or two. That's going to be very close to the final version. So you've got two versions that are the farthest apart they're ever going to be.
Okay. So I have a 17285, and then I have a 17115.
Right.
And RS4.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what would you do? Would you have them both on 17285?
Well, it kind of depends what you're looking for. First of all, I don't run the Insider's builds. As much as I'd like to know what's coming, I want my systems to be fairly stable. So I just let Microsoft handle my Windows updates. You're doing something that Microsoft loves and enthusiasts should absolutely do, which is testing the next version of Windows for Microsoft. And they've had some great success doing this with, they call it the Insiders Program, because they get literally millions of people trying the new version of Windows before the rest of us. And that's a good thing, because the more people test a version, the more likely you'll find bugs before you get there. Now, you've become even more aggressive when you go to this skip ahead, the next Insider build, because you're not just, as I said, you're not using the version that is soon to be released. You're using the version that is farthest from release that they offer anybody except people inside of Microsoft. So I don't have a suggestion for you, except that, you know, as they explain, although people don't probably read this, when you sign up for this, you've got to think carefully. You know, I would have always one machine, your workhorse machine, sometimes we call it the production machine, that's the one you use day to day. That should not be on any Insider ring at all. You go into the settings and turn off the Insider ring and go back to being just normal Windows. You can't do it until there's 1803 comes out. When it does come out, turn off the Insider ring on your main machine, your number one machine, and get that just normal. Don't be a beta tester, an early tester. But if you're an enthusiast, you have more than one machine, and a secondary machine, you don't mind if it from time to time fails or doesn't work, then it's fine to do an Insider build on it. You're on Redstone 4 on both of them, which means you're on skip ahead on both of them. You're on different skip aheads, and that you can't control. Microsoft pushes out different versions, so it's not unusual if you have multiple machines on the beta program, on the Windows Insider program. It's not unusual for you to have different builds on it. The Redstone 3, the 1803 builds, should all be fairly close at this point, because we're close to release. You know, Microsoft's not testing a bunch of different stuff. But so I think 2.8 is the, wow, I mean, I don't know. You're a good candidate to listen to my Windows Weekly podcast, a show I do with two real Windows experts. I'm not. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. Paul is on all the different, you know, insider builds, and he does skip ahead. There are some cool things. One thing in 17.6.2.3 is they've put support for the high efficiency image file format, HAIF, which is great. I'm very happy to be seeing that. That's for RS5 though. That's for the skip ahead. So I'm confusing myself. I guess RS4 is 18.03. RS5 is a skip ahead. RS stands for Redstone. That's the code name for this version of Windows. I gather that your question is, which one should you be on? I personally think, you know, if you've got machines, I have many Windows machines. I'm not an insider builds on any of them because I want the most stable version of Windows. Bad enough when we have a big creators update. I got everything, got to make sure it all works. I don't want to get an update every day or every week. And that's what you get on the Insiders program, especially as you get closer to the final release. But if you're asking me, the skip ahead is for somebody who really has a hankering to know what's next, like this high-efficiency image format. Oh, I really want to see that stuff. But when you get skip ahead versions, there's no guarantee that you're going to get something that comes out. Microsoft's testing stuff. They're testing stuff for you. My recommendation is to get off the insiders. If you go to the slow ring, there's several rings. The slow ring will be the most safe if you want to be an insider. Fast ring will be the least safe. And skip ahead, well, who knows what you're going to get. Good luck. My advice to most people is don't be a beta tester. You have to be an enthusiast. And frankly, there's also a higher obligation. I don't know if Microsoft emphasizes this, but if you're a beta tester, your job is to try to break it, find ways that it breaks, and then tell Microsoft, submit forms, appropriate bug reports. That's actually a high duty. You got to take it seriously. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're dependent on all of you. I can't even keep track of it. Skip ahead's made everything cuckoo. So 17.128... is for RS4. RS4 is 18.03. We're on RS3 now. RS5 is skip ahead. This 28 came out yesterday, right? For fast ringers. We are not done yet. We're now beginning the final phase of checking in final code to prepare for final release. There was a build 127 on Tuesday. They've removed the watermark in 128, so it's not much different. 127 is now going to the slow ring. So I guess my answer is just let go and let Microsoft. And if I were you, I'd get off all the rings. I did the insider program for a while. It was so frustrating, I just got it off. I got off of it. I just said, nah. But I'll put a link in the show notes to Donna Sakar's posting on the Windows blog. That's who you want to. You want to follow Donna on Twitter. And on her blog at the, what is it? It's blogs.windows.com/Windows Experience. And then this will give you the most information about what you're getting. So you have two different machines on two different builds. That's not unusual. That's what you signed up for. Slow ring is at 127, fast ring is at 128, skip ahead's at RS5, so I guess you're not in skip ahead. That's so crazy. And then there's a release preview ring. I don't know, you know, I thought some of this I think is not beta testing, but marketing on Microsoft's part, frankly. I know. I know. I'm sorry, user 4705. I feel like I'm speaking in tongues. It is confusing. I'm confused, obviously. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's really crazy when you think about it. I hadn't really kind of sat down and thought about what Microsoft's doing with their pre-release versions of Windows. It is a great thing for Microsoft to test this with serious users who understand Windows or hardcore users, will go into all the nooks and crannies, try features that maybe normal users wouldn't try before it's released to the public. That's great. That's called beta testing. It's pre-release testing. And when you're doing something like an operating system like Windows with hundreds of millions of lines of code and potential for lots of bugs, the more you can get people to bang on it before you release it, the better. People who do beta testing, they're really two groups of people who do it. There's people who do it because it's cool, man. I have the latest version of Windows before you do, you know. And those people are less helpful than the people, maybe they're IT professionals who want to test before they, you know, deploy Windows in the office. Or they're just people who care a lot about Windows, like to use it, and want to help Microsoft. That second group is the most important group because those are the people who will take the time to do bug reports, fill that out. And bug reports require a lot of effort because you have to try to recreate the bug, explain exactly how it happened. It's not useful to Microsoft unless you're very thorough in your description of the problem. Otherwise, it's hard for them to find it and fix it. So there's a high responsibility. Unfortunately, I think Microsoft uses this program. They call it the Insider Program. That should tell you something. It's more marketing than it is actual beta testing. Maybe they get a little benefit of the beta testing as a result of doing it, because certainly millions of people are using Windows. It does seem like the last few versions of Windows have been pretty reliable. But on the other hand, not so long ago, we had a version of Windows come out that had horrific problems. They had to fix it real quick. And you had to wonder, well, why didn't the beta testers, if they're testing on millions of people, why did the beta testers find it? They released a version of Windows, I think it was about a year ago, that if you plugged a Kindle into it, it crashed. The whole machine crashed. And it disabled many cameras, including, you know, the webcams, including Microsoft's own. And that then, in my mind, it raised a question. Well, I wonder, is this really this insider's program? Is this really qualifying as a pre-release test among, you know, people who are taking the time to report problems? Because if they miss two massive problems like that, how good is this pre-release testing? Surely some of those insiders had Kindles. I know almost all of them had webcams. And nobody bothered to tell Microsoft? Or Microsoft didn't get enough information? Or what happened? Did they release the version anyway with massive bugs? Now, that hasn't happened since. So maybe they've fixed that problem. But if you're going to be an insider, come please do us all a favor. Do your job and find bugs and report them effectively to Microsoft so they can squash them. So that the rest of us who are not anxious to try pre-release software on our systems get a reliable operating system. That would be nice. That would be nice. Public betas are all the rage, and I really do think the name tells it all. It's a marketing thing for Microsoft. It takes their most enthusiastic customers and gives them a little something on the inside, and now they're even more enthusiastic. That's really the value of it for Microsoft. It's a shame because massive beta tests are so valuable. I stopped doing the insider build. It was just crazy. It was too many new versions. Every time you get a new version, by the way, you run the risk of making your machine unusable. And people who are on the insider, getting the latest insider builds, at least once or twice a year are going to get a build that crashes, that destroys your machine, and you have to rebuild it. It's not worth it. It really isn't, in my opinion, unless... And God bless you if you are. You're one of those people who says, no, I want to help the world. I want to help Microsoft make better software. I am going to take this seriously. I'm going to install this stuff, and I'm going to bang on it till I can break it, and then I'm going to report it fully and accurately to Microsoft so they can fix it. If that's you, please, please be a Windows Insider. Thank you. I thank you, and the community thanks you. You're doing important work. Looky-loos, you... You're not helping. I guess they're not hurting either, right? They're not hurting. So I guess it's all right. If you want to be an insider, fine. Let's see. Back to the phones. Next, Jerry in Pennsylvania. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Leo. Before we start, how's the audio? Do you have a hum?
Yeah, it's a little hum in it, but that's all right. I understand. What's going on?
Let me move away. Leo, I've got a new laptop with a horrible Windows 10 in it, and I'm
yeah.
And I plugged a mouse in there, a wireless mouse with a little bitty dongle. It worked great. All of a sudden, one day, it stops working. So I try a different mouse. Doesn't work. Take the mice downstairs, different computer. There's no problem. So I had to bring up an old Microsoft mouse with a receiver the size of a hockey puck.
Yeah.
I plugged it in. It works great.
Yeah.
Where should I look for my problem at, Leo?
Well, wireless mice have problems in all sorts of areas. The dongle, I presume, plugs into the USB port, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so if the wireless mouse is working, and of course the first thing I do is check the batteries.
Well, no, they work great in my other computer.
Okay, so as long as the batteries are okay. And that's one of the reasons I don't like wireless mice, because they fail, and they fail, of course, when you need the mouse the most. But as long as the batteries are okay, the dongle should make that mouse look exactly like the wired mouse to your computer, because the dongle is a USB interface for a mouse. And Logitech makes these. I presume it's Logitech. They're easily the most popular. It's just a little thing you put in the USB port, and then the mouse communicates with that, and then that communicates with the computer. In Logitech's case, they do have software. So the first thing I would do, just to see if everything's working, is to get the software, the mouse software from the company that makes that mouse. If it's Logitech, it's easy to get it, logitech.com. But, you know, whoever makes the mouse, see if they have some specialized software. You shouldn't need a driver, because that dongle is going to show up in most cases as a USB HID, human interface device. It's a standard profile. Any computer should understand it without any additional software. But just in case, get the software. Maybe the firmware needs to be updated. Maybe there's something wrong. The software will give you some diagnostics. It'll tell you, for instance, if it sees the dongle. If it doesn't, well, maybe the dongle's broken. Maybe the port's broken. Maybe that computer, you know, a Windows 10 computer should have no trouble with it. But get this software. Try your other USB ports. Sometimes USB ports, are broken. But my guess is if you install the software, that thing will get working. If it doesn't, you'll have a much better idea of why it's not working. I do use, Logitech MX Anywhere mouse is a great little mouse. It's small. I carry it in my briefcase with me in case I want to use a mouse on somebody else's device. And I put the dongle in the mouse. It's nice. It nestles right in there. And then that way, if I want a little portable mouse I can use, I have it. And I find that very handy. But for day-to-day use, like right now, I'm using an old classic Microsoft wired USB mouse. Because it's reliable. I don't want my mouse to fail in the middle of the show. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. DeleteFacebook.com. Now they've created a site. I love it. To go with a hashtag. I could go back. I still have time. My Facebook account won't disappear for another 6 days. But I don't think I'm going to go back. I don't miss it. The only second thoughts I'm having is, I guess, for the radio. You know, I'll lose my pages. I have a Leo Laporte page, and I guess for the radio show. But I don't know. Deactivation is not deletion. Consider an account deletion epitaph. I didn't do that. Problem is, as soon as the deletion happens in a week, That's gonna go away too, so I didn't bother doing that. I don't think anybody cares anyway if I have a Facebook account or not. So, all my friends will miss me. I should show you that page. Boy, is that a yeah. I don't have time to tweet, and Twitter's such a cesspool. I don't know if I really want to spend much time on Twitter. I go there and if somebody dies or. When we get in war with North Korea, I'll probably use it more. But for now, I don't miss Twitter much either. And I killed Instagram and WhatsApp too, right? because I don't want Facebook to have any presence on my devices. Yeah, yeah. And Twitter is pretty disgusting. There's nothing on any social network that I feel like if I don't have it, I'll miss it. And it just, especially in these difficult times, it doesn't make me feel better. I am very much in touch because I read the news nonstop. I mean, I have, you know, when I launch my browser, techmemes/.nuzzle and Reddit all pop up on my browser. Those are my home pages. And I check those several times a day, but that's for the shows, you know, so I have tech, I'm looking for tech stories. So I don't feel like I'm, you know, unaware. Certainly, I have better ways to get news than Twitter or Facebook. If there's any family members who want to get a hold of me, they can reach me by calling me or texting me. That works pretty well. I don't think I'm missing anything. You're just trying to pull me in, Mike. Gallup has published a poll that says that we're more unhappy than ever before. It's not our economy. It's going well. Subjective well-being is down nationwide. And I think that that's because of social media. From 2016 to 2017, America saw its largest year-over-year drop in well-being in the 10 years since they've tracked the data. By the way, this is 2.5 million people surveyed, so it's a 21 states registered absolute declines in their level of well-being. Not a single state showed a statistically significant improvement in 2017. The states showing the worst decline: Nevada, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, and Indiana, the Rust Belt states. And economically, they probably are doing worse, I would guess. The happiest states: South Dakota, Vermont, Hawaii, Minnesota, North Dakota, Colorado, New Hampshire, Idaho, Utah, Montana. The states where there are no people. Unhappiest: Rhode Island, Indiana, Nevada, Ohio, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Arkansas. These actually are economic downturn areas, I think, I suspect. But well-being declined almost everywhere, including California. And I think that's social. I think that's social media. I really do. I can promise. And surveys are bunk anyway. I grew up in Rhode Island. Yeah, Rhode Islanders are angry about everything. But the economy in Rhode Island is terrible. Well, Cumulus and iHeart have both done a Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization. I don't know anybody else. But that's the latest. But the good news is iHeart was able to cut its debt in half. So, iHeart makes a lot of money. So they have good cash flow and good profits. So I think that probably they're in good shape. They tell us they are. Isn't it sad the guy who started Toys R Us just died like a few days after the last store closed? Oh, man. Isn't it ironic? Don't you think?
Simply Safe.
A little bit ironic. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Yes, indeedy. Time to talk tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number. I'm going to do a whole bunch of calls this hour, I think. I've been talking too much. 888-827-5536. And good news, because I'm going on vacation next month, we're going to record some calls after the show ends. So we'll keep going. If you have a hard time getting through, I know it's hard when we're on the air, give me an hour, and I will keep going for another 45 minutes after the show ends. So that would be a good time to call. Write the number down. 8888-ASK-LEO. Website techguylabs.com. It's free, no sign up required, and That's where we put all the show information, links, stuff I talk about. There's even audio and video of past shows up there. TechGuyLabs.com. Line 3, Brian, Indio, California. Hello, Brian.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. Let's see if you could. I've never heard you handle one of these problems yet. I don't. But since you're in the audio and video, I think you could. You can do it.
Maybe I can help
Amazon,
you.
The Amazon Fire Stick, and I'm having a problem getting it logged in.
Okay. So you plug it into your TV's HDMI port. You have a TV with an HDMI port, right? Turn on the TV and go to that HDMI, and you see it, right?
Yeah, but the problem I have is that when I get down to creating the password, the remote control locks up.
Oh, that's no good. You have you been able to get it onto your Wi-Fi? That's, of course, important step two. Did it join the Wi-Fi fine?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just logging into your Amazon account you can't do. Is that right?
Yeah, because the remote locks up.
Yeah.
And I've replaced the batteries and...
You might just have a bad one. I don't know what's wrong with it. I've never had this problem happen. Not sure why it's a problem. When you get a Fire TV, it's set up to work with your Amazon account already. So all it's asking you to do is confirm that this is you, log in, and it uses your Amazon account because, of course, if you have Amazon Prime, you get Prime movies and all of that stuff. So it does need that information. That's kind of how a Fire TV works. It's really why it's designed. You know, it's designed to be an Amazon product. If the remote locks up, you can, I believe, I'm trying to remember if the Fire Stick will do this. Maybe the chat room will help me. I think the Fire Stick may be able to work with an external Bluetooth keyboard. Nevertheless, even if you could, I wouldn't suggest it because it sounds like there's something wrong with the remote. So, now remember, there can be delays, but I don't think that that's it. I think it's time to call Amazon. And they, you know what? The good thing about this is they'll send you a new one in about 5 seconds. You'll send the old one back, of course, but they'll send you a new one before you even send the old one back. And I think you should do this because even if we could get around this problem, this is not good. There's something wrong with it. Any suggestions, though? I don't use the Fire Stick. I was very tempted. They had a real deal yesterday on the new Fire TV dongle. It's like a Fire Stick, but it's a little bigger. It's 4K. I think it was $35. Normally like $60 or $70. I thought, well, I should get that. But frankly, I've had an Amazon Fire TV sitting on my shelf for a year or two. I just never got around to setting it up. I have enough stuff. Chatroom is suggesting, and it's maybe, again, this is a workaround, but there is a Fire Stick app for your smartphone. If you have a smartphone, put that on there and pair it to your Fire Stick. You can use a smartphone instead of a remote. Maybe you're willing to just get rid of, maybe the remote isn't important to you. If you can do it on the phone, then that would be a workaround that might work for you. But you should have a remote that works, frankly. Florida, David on the line. Hi, David.
Hello, Leo. Thank you for having me on air this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling. I detect a little Baltimore, Philly, Mid-Atlantic accent in there.
Well, Mid-Atlantic, Philly is absolutely correct.
All right.
Absolutely correct. All right. I'm loving it here in Florida for the past 15 years. I'm on what we call the nature coast down here along the Gulf of Mexico. Just beautiful.
A snowbird. You know, I've wanted to go down there. I've thought about retiring there many times. You don't mind the humidity?
I don't find the humidity any worse than it was back in the Philadelphia area.
Yes, you're right.
To be honest with you.
And the giant bugs, you can live with those.
No, we got snakes that eat the bugs, so that's not a problem.
And then the gators eat the snakes, so really it's good all around.
It's a big circle. You don't have to shovel the snow, Leo. You don't have
Oh, I know that one. And I bet your friends in Philly are not having a good time this winter. Oh, man.
Well, they don't want to hear from me anymore. They're tired.
Last 4 weeks. Now, Toby, what can I do for you?
It's beautiful here today.
Oh, I bet. Well,
listen, Leo, I listen to you every week, and it's you have an amazing program, and I go out to the website. And to be honest with you, at my age, even though I'm a ham radio operator for many years and done computers and all that sort of thing, a lot of what goes on these days goes right over my head.
It's hard. You know, it's hard for me to keep up. I spend every minute, every waking hour, paying attention, yeah. And I still have a hard time keeping up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm jealous when I hear that you absolutely, because of business, have to buy the absolute.
I have to.
Current stuff. You know?
What can I say? Jealous. It's very I have jealous. To.
Yep, yep. Well, I'm stuck with an old Samsung smartphone, a J3, I think it is.
Oh yeah,
like that.
Oh,
that
yeah.
works fine.
That's fine.
That's
yeah.
fine for me.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm calling about something that's not nearly as high tech as what you've been talking about for the past hour.
Okay.
And this is a problem that I keep coming up with, and it seems to me it's a very simplistic problem, but I run into it every day.
What's the problem?
Here's the problem. I use AOL. I use Avast. I use MSN, Bing, Mozilla Firefox, Google Chrome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone wants to know if they should save the passwords that I use.
Say no.
So, well, I'm dumb enough that I always say, yeah, that'll make my life easier. Make my life easier.
Yeah.
Well, I finally figured out,
yeah.
even though all of my passwords have 12 to 18 characters, you know, make them complex and everything else. So I got to save them because I'll be darned if I can remember them.
Right.
I do write them down.
Right.
I just replaced, about 3 months ago, replaced an old 7-year-old Lenovo with an HP Envy desktop, model 750.
Very nice. Good choice. Yeah.
14.
Yeah.
Got 128 gigs, solid state drive, a terabyte hard drive, and Windows 10,
yada. So what's the problem you're having with having these guys remember your passwords?
Well, here's what it seems to me, and I could very well be wrong. But they all, when I try to sign into the internet, they're all fighting with each other as to which password I should
use.
So
it's my turn. It's mine. I want to.
They don't let me in. I have to work.
Yeah. So this is one of a number of problems that can happen when you have too many. You in effect have multiple password managers. You should. I mean, your browsers will remember your passwords. Firefox will remember your passwords. I would. You know, AOL. If you're using the AOL client, like you can't believe you are. You're probably using Firefox for that as well, right?
I think I go in through Google.
Here's what I would do. The reason I don't like to use browser passwords managers, it's okay. Firefox does have syncing so that when you get a new machine, you install Firefox, it's going to synchronize. And it'll remember your passwords, but it's not as complete a solution as a real password manager. And there's always the concern that these browsers, because it's not their main business, are not as secure. I'm going to recommend you turn that feature off in everything. Say, don't remember my password. If Avast is remembering your password, it's not Avast. It's probably Windows. Or a browser. Bing, that's the browser. AOL, that's the browser. But I don't like bat browsers. I'd say go out, get LastPass. It's a much more secure password manager. It's the one I use. You use that and have that be the only thing. Then you don't have this conflict because when a password prompt does pop up, it's from LastPass, and it knows which password's the right password. You won't have these problems. So, and LastPass makes it very easy. It's very secure. It uses strong encryption. You only have to remember one password. That's the LastPass password. All the others, you can let it generate good, strong passwords so they don't have your birthday in it, your dog, your kid's name, nothing like that. They just have complete garbage, random characters that are impossible to remember. But LastPass remembers them. You just remember one password. That's your LastPass password. I strongly recommend that. It's $25 a year, worth every penny. As I said, it's what I use and recommend. There are other good password managers out there. 1Password's another one. All of them are better than Firefox or Chrome or any browser that you use. They're more secure because it's their business. It's their number one business. I highly recommend it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's take a little time out. More of your calls still to come. I know why you're playing this, Michael Cozio, musical director. We were talking earlier during the break about Charles Lazarus, the founder of Toys R Us, really kind of a legend in the business, passed away at the age of 94, just a few days after Toys R Us announced it was closing its stores. Isn't it ironic? 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Actually, that's not really the meaning of ironic, but then again, the song isn't either, so we'll let the English teachers go and just, you know, enjoy ourselves. On the line from Garden Grove, California, Henry. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm great. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Hey, I was calling you. I have Wi-Fi out in Arizona. That's wireless. And I want to extend the range on it. What would you recommend for the extender?
So it depends on how far you want to go. How far do you want to go?
Well, I don't want to go that far. I just want to make sure I can get it upstairs.
Oh, upstairs is easy. It's harder if you want to go 200 feet out into the backyard or something like that. But just getting it upstairs, downstairs, there's two ways to do it. Actually, there's multiple ways to do it. I'll give you a few.
Okay.
If you already have a router, and your problem, I take it, is it works fine when you're downstairs, but as soon as you go upstairs, it's a weak signal or no signal. Is that right?
Well, I haven't really checked the signal upstairs, but I can get connected upstairs.
All right. So is it slow? Does it feel slow when you're up there?
Well,
in other words, why? What is the problem if it works?
Well, I just think I'd like to have put an extender on it.
You'd like it a little better. All right.
A little better.
So the problem with extenders, and this is how we've done it for years, is you generally want an extender that matches the access point. So if you have a Linksys, get a Linksys. If you have a Netgear, get a Netgear. But all the companies that make routers also have extenders. But there is a problem with extenders. They cut the speed in half. And the reason is half the time they're talking to you upstairs, half the time they're talking to the access point downstairs. So they're not giving you their full attention. That means it cuts the speed literally in half. Not necessarily bad if you've got a lot of speed on your internet access. Maybe not even a problem. But there is a newer solution that I like a little bit better, but it would require you buying not just an extender, but a new access point. I'm going to tell you about that. You don't have to do this, but you can. These are the new mesh routers. All the companies make these. I think somebody's calling you. I like that ringtone.
No.
No. Go away. I'm talking. If you get a mesh router, and Eero's a sponsor, and they're the one I use at home, but there's many companies that make these. Google, Linksys, Netgear all have their versions of these mesh routers. Yeah. Generally, you buy them with a base station. You have to buy a specialized base station and the extenders, one, two, or three, depending on how much. Usually, I think of it as one unit per 1,500 square feet. But that you might need more than that because of the upstairs-downstairs issue. You'd at least need one downstairs, one upstairs. They're more expensive for that reason, but they have some advantages. First of all, they don't cut in half the speed. You get full duplex communication. That's the biggest difference, frankly. Also, because these are newer and they have smarter software, they often have additional features. Eero, for instance, has a safety features, the filtering features for kids. You can turn it off via an Amazon Echo. You can maintain it. All of these mesh systems, pretty much, you can maintain on the road by a connection on an app, which is very handy. I can look at my Eero router here. If somebody says there's a problem, I can figure out where the problem lies. They also update. And we were talking last hour about how important it is that your router automatically update. They update automatically. Now, having said that, all the router manufacturers are sitting up and taking notice and adding these features. In fact, you can get an Asus router nowadays that has built-in mesh capabilities. So extenders are kind of on their way out anyway. There are other ways you can do this if you have a really challenging environment. Let's say, for instance, you have, for some reason, metal floors in that second floor. Metal will just stop the Wi-Fi cold. There's no way to get a wireless signal through the metal. If that's the case, then you need to have a wired solution upstairs, and there are ways to do that even without putting in, you know, Ethernet in the house, wiring in the walls. For instance, power line networking, which has come a long way. It's actually pretty good nowadays. You use power line networking to use your grid, your power grid in your house, to in effect act like Ethernet. So with power line networking, you'd have a router downstairs. It would be connected via a cable, via an Ethernet cable, to the power line device plugged into the wall. It's connecting then through the wall wiring to the upstairs power line networking unit, the receiver. It's also plugged into the wall. It can be a Wi-Fi access point itself, giving you a complete new set of Wi-Fi upstairs, or it can have Ethernet that you plug into. It can do a lot of things. So that's fairly inexpensive. TP-Link sells a pair of power line networking devices. I've used them. They're pretty good. and under $100 for both of them. Now, the negative is it really does depend on the quality of your in-house wiring. You said Arizona, that's probably a newer home that's going to have decent wiring. Of course, if there's a fuse box in between them, a junction box of any kind, that'll cause problems. But if it's direct shot and the wiring's fairly new, you're going to get maybe 60, 70% of the total speed through the power line wire networking. So that's three ways to do it. An extender for your existing router, cheapest, easiest, but the least performance. Buy a newer mesh system. People need to upgrade their routers every couple of years anyway. I wish people would get that through their heads, because old routers start to become less reliable, flaky, and they just don't have the features of the newer routers. So look at a mesh system. I personally use Eero. I like Plume. I like Orbi. There are quite a few choices out there now. Third choice, Powerline Networking. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I feel fairly productive, Robert, and I'm using – I decided if I'm going to get 3 days off a week, I better use that time wisely, not playing video games or watching TV. So I am working – I'm taking a online computer class, which is fun, programming class. Really, actually, that's mostly what I'm doing. I'm trying to read more. Get more exercise. I've got a trainer 3 days a week now on my days off. I've got Monday, Thursday, and Friday trainer. What else am I doing? Just trying to, use that time wisely instead of just squandering it. I'm really having fun with this programming class, although I'm very disappointed with my midterm. No, I haven't given it up, Archandra. Someday I'll get in there. But I haven't spent any time doing that. Lou MM, it's a programming course from UBC, University of British Columbia, on EDX. I'll put a link in, based on how to design programs. I've been, for years, every spring I bust out how to design programs. As you know, Lou, I've been a programmer for 30 years, but I always wanted to relearn it right. And I always, people like Peter Norvig and Eric Raymond said, if you learn Lisp, you're going to learn how to really program right. And, they say, hey, there's this special thing that happens when you get it that, the best programmers I know are all kind of Lispers. So this isn't Lisp. It's a beginning student language, which is Lisp-like. Lisp Lite, really, what it is. But it's great. And then we'll see from there. They have a Micro Masters course I'm interested in. It'll take me a few years. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I won't try to figure out why Michael Kozia is playing that one. He often sends me coded messages, But just a word of caution. He is not sending you coded messages, okay? He's not. I promise. Right, Michael? Not them, just me. Kim Schaffer's also been answering the phones. Thank you, Kim. Doing a great job. We're going to keep Kim working a little extra this next hour. I'm going to keep answering calls. We got about a half an hour left of the show, but we are pre-recording calls for future use. So if you would like to get through, don't stop calling when we get to the top of the hour. Keep it going. 8888 Ask Leo. Garth in Neenah, Wisconsin. Hello, Garth.
Hello, Leo. How are you today?
I am well. How are you?
Well, I'm a little bit confused. About 6 or 8 weeks ago, when I turned my phone on first thing in the morning, all of a sudden it started downloading information. And it was the telephone number and address and everything of my second cousin. And I haven't seen or heard from him in 30 years. And it loaded everything. His telephone number, cell phone, landline.
You mean it added that information to your contact list?
Yes.
Okay. So,
where did it come from in the first place?
Well, let me go a couple of steps back here and say something that's, I think, important for everybody to understand, which is that computers, and your phone is a computer, and technology in general, may sometimes appear to do things without rhyme or reason. They may appear mysterious, almost, in fact, magical. In fact, like is there a ghost in the machine? But let me promise you, having really delved deeply, looked very hard, there is nothing magical in any of these boxes. In fact, the truth is, it's all pretty straightforward and simple. Computers simulate intelligence. They don't actually show intelligence and will or anything. They simulate it by doing simple, simple, simple things like addition and subtraction very, very, very fast. And if you do it fast enough, you can actually look like you know what you're doing. But ultimately, there's always a determinist. I use the word deterministic, and that's a big word. But that's the best word for this. There's always a deterministic reason, a real cause and effect for why computers, technology does what it does. There's no voodoo. There's no magic. It's doing it for a reason. Now, I'm going to speculate on the reasons why it's doing this, and there are a couple of them. One of the things smartphone contact lists often do is go out onto your social networks. They won't do it without your permission, but the problem is they ask for permission quickly and sometimes subtly, and you may not have noticed that's what you're doing. But my guess is that your contact list is looking at your Facebook profile, for instance. Maybe your second cousin's on Facebook, or your Twitter profile, or your LinkedIn profile. Intentionally, with purpose, connect all of my contact lists to those services, because that way I get updated phone numbers, updated addresses. In many cases, I get pictures. You know, I don't have pictures of all my contacts, but all my contacts will post their picture on social media. So as a result, my contact list pulls that in, and now I've got a picture, which is nice because when they call, I see a picture of them. So this is a convenience factor. There's a secret, hidden, less talked about reason why they do this. They want that information too. And this is, you know, something we are now, thanks to the attention being paid to Facebook, becoming more aware of. Almost everything on your phone, every application, the operating system itself, the companies that make the phone, the companies that make the operating system, the cell phone carriers that provide the service, almost every single one of those, in fact, I'm going to take the word almost out, every single one of those wants more information about you because they can make money on it. In fact, we talk a lot about Facebook invading your privacy. Facebook's nothing compared to your internet service provider. Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, they've all sold information about their customers to the highest bidder. Every one of them. Every one of them. And every app on your phone, with few exceptions, every phone manufacturer, Samsung, Apple, yes, Apple, they all want your information so they can sell it. So contact managers and a lot of other applications will always say, hey, you know, life would be better if you'd give us your Facebook login or your Google login or whatever login. So almost certainly that information, your phone isn't smart enough. Trust me, it's just a box of rocks. It's working really fast. Your phone isn't smart enough to figure out, oh, that's his second cousin. I better get that information. It's doing something you asked it to do, whether you remember it or not. And almost certainly it's getting that information from one of your social networks, because that's a nice feature, right? And of course, the more addresses, the more phone numbers, the more information they have, the more money they can make. And this is what we saw Facebook doing. And this is why so many people have decided to delete Facebook. DeleteFacebook.com if you'd like to find out how. DeleteFacebook.com. I'm doing it. Because Facebook's entire business model from day one, from Mark Zuckerberg as a Harvard freshman when he wrote the program, he may say, I think life is better when people are connected. And I bet he believes it even. But he never charged for anything on Facebook. You know why? He didn't have to. Because even as a Harvard freshman, he knew there's value in the information I'm getting from people, the stuff they're voluntarily giving me, where they live. You know what the most valuable thing that you're giving Facebook? It's not your address or your birth date. It's your Facebook likes. Do you know how much information people can deduce, can learn from your Facebook likes? I promised to talk about this. Let me see if I can find the article. This goes back a few years to research done on by a university psychology department. They were curious about what they could learn from something that was publicly available, information that people gave out publicly. Turns out, I don't know if you know this, but your likes on Facebook, the pages, the brands, the posts that you like are publicly available. Facebook wants them to be public available. In fact, Facebook makes money, lots of it, on selling that information to the highest bidder, particularly advertisers, but not always. Could be Russia. So what you like can be surprisingly accurately can be an indicator to who you are. For instance, there's mathematical models, and they've done this, and one of the reasons this happens is because we've gotten very good. One of the things computers are really good at is manipulating mass quantities of data very, very quickly and finding correlations, connections between the data. So that's what happened, is they found connections between your likes and who you are. You can actually find out more about this. They created an app called You Are What You Like. This is, guess what? Guess who did this? The University of Cambridge. Oh, yeah, the folks behind Cambridge Analytica. You take a simple psychology quiz. They collect your likes, because actually the real thing they get is your Facebook profile. And they can determine things like your race, your religion, your sexual orientation with massive accuracy. Did you know that people with high IQs, like the Colbert Report, this is old, right? The Godfather, To Kill a Mockingbird, lower IQ people like Harley Davidson, Bret Michaels, the rock band Poison. I'm gonna give you some of these. I'm going to find some of these. We're giving that information away for free. Anyway, to answer your question, I'm sure you connected your contact list to Facebook. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let me give you the link to the story, because it's just
the
amazing.
Holidays may be over, but it's never too late to make.
It's from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Let me see if I can find the original article from 2013. Here it is. Just had to Google it. Google's amazing, isn't it? And they're just fascinating. For instance, let me read some of these here. They had 58,000 volunteers who provided their Facebook likes, detailed demographic profiles, and the results of several psychometric tests. The idea was, let's correlate the likes to the tests to see if we can find connections. 88% of the cases, they could figure out if you were gay or straight. African-American or Caucasian, 95%. Democrat, Republican, 85%. With a surprisingly small number of Facebook likes. That's about 65 likes. I'll give you some of them here. Sexual orientation, ethnic origin, political views, religion, personality, intelligence, satisfaction with life, substance abuse, whether your parents stayed together until you were 21. I mean, mind-boggling, the stuff they could figure out. Let me see here. I read this on Twig. I can't remember where I found it. Okay. Best predictors of high intelligence. So, Dick, do you like thunderstorms?
Yes.
Yes. Colbert Report?
Yes.
Science?
Yeah.
Okay. Curly fries?
Oh, my God, yes.
High intelligence. All of those.
Okay.
Low intelligence.
Okay.
Sephora. I love being a mom. Harley Davidson. Lady Antebellum. Good predictors of male homosexuality, obviously No Hate Campaign, MAC Cosmetics, and the musical Wicked. I guess that's not too much of a surprise. Wow. Strong predictors of male heterosexuality, the Wu-Tang Clan, Shaquille O'Neal. But this is the one I love. And it being confused after waking up from naps. Straight guys love that group.
That is a riot.
Isn't that wild? Hello Kitty. If you like Hello Kitty, you tend to be high on openness, but low on conscientiousness, agreeableness, and emotional stability. Hello Kitty lovers are also more likely to have democratic political views, predominantly Christian, slightly below average age, and African American.
Oh, my God. I think Rotten Tomatoes should start incorporating that.
Yeah, so. We're good at this. Why can't we get can't we get recommendations on Netflix to work? I ask you.
Exactly.
All right, here we go. We're going to keep going. If you're on the phone, hang on. I have more calls coming after the top of the hour. Don't. So the course that I put the link up in at UC is part of a what they call a micro master's course that ends up creating web apps with TypeScript. You'll like that, Lou MM. That's Microsoft's kind of JavaScript front end, and I think Node, and maybe Angular. Starts with Lisp, ends with Node. That's life. Yeah, baby. Love to hear Dick DiBartolo. He is our Giz Whiz, Mad's Maddest writer for many years and a Gizmo fan, a wizard of gizmos, if you will, coming to us from the snowbound Gizneyland.
The snow is all gone. I'm happy to report.
Toby didn't leave anything behind, huh?
No, we had two 45-degree days, and it melted everything instantly.
Wow.
So that was good. That was good.
Well, hello, Dickie D. What can I do for you? What can we talk about this
week? Well, you know what? I have another great gadget for you. It's also from the big houseware show in Chicago. Now, you actually cook food. I mean,
I actually cook food. I don't just eat it. I cook it.
You cook it.
Then I eat it.
Yeah. So I like this just from boiling water. All right.
Okay.
So it's a new line of cookware. It is used in industry and mainly restaurants. It's called Turbo Pot Cookware.
Not Instapot, but Turbo Pot.
Turbo Pot.
It's not quite as fast as Instant Pot.
Well, Instant Pot, wasn't that the thing that you could charge USB gadgets with?
No, that was a good one, though. That was something you put on your campfire that would boil the water and charge your phone.
And charge your phone.
So what is the Turbo Pot?
Okay, so Turbo Pot is, on electronics, they use heat sinks to draw the heat away from the works.
Right.
So Turbo Pot makes heat sinks that are fins that attach to the bottom of their stainless steel pots.
Ooh.
And it actually increases the amount of heat going into the pot. And I took a 7.5
inch. It's funny. I mean, pots haven't changed in 1,000 years.
Exactly. So this is great fun. I took a regular saucepan. I had an 8 inch and I had a 7.5 inch turbo pot. And I adjusted the flame and I used one of those non-contact thermometers to get the flame about the same temperature.
Just aim the thing.
Exactly. And the turbo pot boiled a cup of water in a minute.
Yeah.
And the other pot took almost 2 minutes.
Wow. If my calculations are correct, twice as fast.
Right. Well, they say 30 to 50 times faster. And
well, that's a little more than twice as fast, but okay.
Yeah. And they have some videos on their website done by PG&E. And as a matter of fact,
this only works with gas or does it work?
Yes. I was just going to say that. Only on gas, not electric, not induction.
Yeah.
And, California is very advanced. Some gas companies are starting to offer rebates for people who buy.
Well, I have a gas stove. I'm going to have to get me some turbo stuff.
Turbo style.
And nice cookware? I mean,
they have non-skid, industrial strength, non-skid. The saucepan's all stainless, really nice, and not expensive. The saucepan is $49. The frying pan, I believe, is $44.
You have it on Amazon.
Amazon.
From your website.
It's so funny. 3 days ago, it wasn't on Amazon. So they're just coming into the home consumer market.
I'm going to order a few turbo pots.
Okay.
Yeah. Or as we say in France, turbo pose.
Boy, you are. You just know everything about it. The thing you really broke my heart when you said earlier that there's no magic inside electronic components.
Yes, I know. Isn't that depressing? Gosh. We thought there was some magic in there. No.
I don't call tech help. I light incense.
How do you clean bottom of the turbo pot?
You know what? The turbo pot, the company says that the pot is designed so that anything dripping down will go under the pot and will not go into the fins. So I'm taking your word on that, because boiling water does not leave a lot of residue if it overflows.
That's safe. Yeah. All right. I'm going to get some, turbo pots. So they have, they're not horribly expensive. An 8-quart stock pot, which could be hundreds of dollars if you got the fancy stuff, is only $79. And they got a $44 10-inch non-stick frying pan. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I admire you because you know what to put in those kind of pots.
Yeah. Water. Lots boiling water.
Don't steal that's the only recipe I have. Please don't steal it.
I boil my water with a recipe I got from Dick DiBartolo.
Yes,
he got it from his mother. Yes.
Generation.
It's the best boiled water you'll have. Thank you, Dickie D. If you go to gizwiz.biz, that's his website, gizwiz.biz, and click the Gizwiz Visits the Tech Guy, you'll see a link to the Turbo Pot and a video that Dick shot, his famous, world-famous one-take theater.
Yes, exactly.
Because he's too lazy to do a second take.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And while you're there, play the What the Heck Is It contest, a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. All you have to do is identify a close-up picture of a gizmo or gadget. Do we have another month before this ends, or is it
the end of April.
End of April. Okay. So, hie thee hither. Gizwiz.biz. Don't forget Dick's great podcast, gizwiz.tv, for the Gizwiz program. Thank you, Dickie D.
Thank you, sir. A gentleman.
You just cost me a couple $100. I'm going to buy me some turbo pots. I was thinking about buying a convection top, or induction top, one of those. But I'd have to buy new pots for that, but these wouldn't work with it. So
no.
Maybe I'll save $1,000 on the new stovetop and just get some turbo pots.
There you go.
Thanks to you.
Okay, pal.
Thank you, Dickie D. We're going to take another call before the end of the show, but I promise you, if you're on the line, we will get to you. We're going to continue to take calls after the show ends, so keep the phones going at 8888-ASK-LEO. I've got some recording to do for time off in the future. You could help me out a little bit. Call and ask your question, like Andre from Irvine, California. Hello, Andre.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for calling.
Doing well. Just a nice Saturday with the kids.
Nice. What can I do to help you with your technology? Yeah, I hear them. Yeah.
I have a couple Nests thermostats at the house.
Okay.
I heard you talking about the Internet of Things.
Yeah, Nest. The good news about Nest, they're a Google company. They were one of the first to do automatic updates. You probably noticed your Nest updates from time to time.
Yeah. My question was, the way I connected them to my wireless router was I had created a guest network for guests that come to the house.
Yep.
And I connected the Nest to the guest network, and I was curious, is that any more secure than
unfortunately not, because when somebody's on your network as a guest, even though they don't know your password, they do have access to your entire network. And that's the problem with any IoT device we were talking about at the beginning of the show, is that once they're on your network, a bad guy who could hack the... Now, the good thing is the Nest is secure. I have no issues with the Nest. But if they could hack the Nest, even though it's a guest on your network, they'd get access to the whole network. There are some devices, my Plume does this, that offer an internet-only guest network. But the best way, well, and I don't necessarily recommend this, is using VLANs. Some sophisticated routers will do that, or multiple, three routers. I think you're fine. I think the truth is, get a device like Nest that updates and keep it up to date. That's the best solution. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.